For the Exascale Report, I'm Mike Bernhardt. In this exclusive Exascale Report interview with Indiana University's Thomas Sterling, we break down a number of exascale topics with a very candid look at the good, the bad, and the, well, not so attractive efforts and results of 2011. If you're interested in exascale, you really should read the contributed article and listen to the audio podcast, which is not just a transcription of the article, but a separate interview discussion that expands on points made in this thought-provoking piece. We're very pleased to present you with this exclusive feature interview with Indiana University's Professor Thomas Sterling. So Thomas, as we've wrapped up 2011, in your article you state that it's been a critical year for exascale computing. It's been both a disappointment and there's some positive aspects to it. But overall, how would you say, on a scale of 1 to 10, or picture the meter, the exascale progress meter, where have we ended up? Poor being the worst possible situation, excellent being the best?
Well, a number I'd give it is probably somewhere around 4. That sounds fairly pessimistic, but it's not intended to. If I thought we had made no progress whatsoever, I would be giving it a 1. And therefore, I feel we are closer to the target than we were. However, there have been as many disappointments as opportunities for the future. So on average, it has to be somewhere around 4.
Okay. And specifically regarding UHPC and OHPC, a lot of people in the community, of course, are really concerned. Is it just politics, or is it a lack of understanding of the importance of the technology direction needed for this country that's resulted in OHPC being canceled and the situation that we're in today?
I'm not qualified to comment on the political side of the decisions that have been made, reflected by DARPA's actions over the last year. I do think there is, on the part of higher level management, a lack of vision both in the area of the criticality of advancement of HPC and the achievement of something on the order of exascale towards the end of this decade, both in terms of economics and in national needs and requirements. I think there's also a failure of vision and deep understanding in the critical details for the innovation that's essential in order to achieve those goals. I believe the combination of those two, and quite possibly with addition of politics, has played a role. But anyone standing and just looking at what's happened can see a sharp and unfortunate negative U-turn in DARPA's program in the area of advanced high-performance computing. So I don't think it's a terribly radical view to be somewhat despondent about the DARPA contribution.
Right. And from our perspective, we see the burden here of technology leadership for the U.S. now falling squarely on the shoulders of DOE. Is that a naive perspective, or how would you describe it?
I think that's exactly correct. Those of us of a more advanced age can remember the 1980s when DARPA was the technology leader, at least in hardware architecture, with many different possible and experimental design points being considered. I think of that as the golden age of supercomputing architecture research. We find DARPA has essentially abrogated any claim to those positions now, and is pushing itself as a non-player, non-entity, both in contributing, but also in having the right to dictate any of those directions or the needs. Fortunately, the separate program under Department of Energy, and let me comment on what I think is a very constructive cooperation between Office of Science and NNSA, a degree of cooperation that speaks very highly for the leadership in both organizations. And they have clearly accepted the responsibility, the challenge, and the need to set the direction, as well as the investment for high-end, high-performance computing progress.
So the U.S. position today, some people are saying, we've fallen into possibly third position in terms of technology leadership related to, extreme computing. What's your perspective on world geography as it relates to exascale?
Well, again, anyone can look at something as simplistic as the top 500 list. I say simplistic, but not in a pejorative manner. those numbers do speak for themselves. We find that when duplicating innovation that's already been made in the U.S. is simply a process of asserting mass, that Asia has always been very good at this. They're very good at the engineering, and they've demonstrated that in high-performance computing. Again, those of us of an advanced age can remember essentially all of consumer electronics migrating to the Pacific Rim, and the U.S. losing all of the economic advantage that that should have provided after essentially having created it. This means that, to that degree, we'll see the same thing happening in rack and stack 'em or just system integration in the high-end computing, taking, again, nothing away from the accomplishments that the Chinese have made in recent years. I'm impressed, and I expect that we're going to be impressed even further as they take on more and more of the technology themselves, eventually providing an all-Chinese machine, duplicating what we're capable of now in essentially the MPP and cluster configuration. The Japanese with K-E-I, have surprised us by being able to, if anything, duplicate again their remarkable accomplishments back in the days of the Earth simulator by multiplying by more than an integer the factor performance gain to bring us to the 10 petaflops area, and by doing so by advancement, some incremental advancements in architecture itself. I was very pleased to see those advancements. So, in terms of large systems, we find that internationally there's a significance in the Pacific Rim. On the European side, we find a renewed energy and initiative on their part, principally in software, but a strong willingness to resume playing a role in hardware. The Europeans have, in many cases, outshone us by taking ideas such as grid technology and others and applying them in very practical and useful ways with less hype and more utility than occurs in the U.S., that, of course, is a personal opinion. The EESI, or European Exascale Software Initiative, is an example on the European side of taking initiative with the intent of playing a leadership role in the international community. What's most important is to understand that it is an international community, that what happens in the future will be contributed to and defined by all elements of the planet. And the U.S. is now working within that cooperation, within that collegium, rather than having a free rein over all technology, hardware and software, programming methods, application algorithms, and so forth. We have to play in that role. We have to lead within that role, but we cannot completely own in that role. And we may, if we fail to take on the responsibility of leadership, we may simply be buying the products from Europe and Asia if we don't regain our former initiative.
And I think what a lot of us forget about, just because they're somewhat silent compared to the other geographies right now, is Russia. And I believe Russia's initiatives today are, you know, they're driven as much out of, you know, pride of country and state as anything, but they also have a deep, deep understanding of the importance of scientific research and the importance to their own nation. And I think they're going to be a contender in this exascale race as well.
Yeah, there's no question about that Russia is a potential powerhouse in this area. I visited Moscow State University just under 2 years ago. I've met with some of their leaders much more recently than that. While their machines are not the most powerful, they're still of significance, but more importantly is the strong engineering, both practical and innovative approaches that they're willing to take. The Russians very much could emerge as a key player. There's a strong impetus in creating a much more valuable educational capability within Russia to rapidly expand the number of experts in application as well as in the engineering and new methods. And this recognition of investment in education to increase their skill force at the same time that we seem to be decreasing within the U.S. Should be cautionary for all of us. And by the way, I might add that the Chinese are increasing their educational efforts as well. One thing I'll say about the Russian machine, Lomonosov, forgive the mispronunciation, is it's the loudest supercomputer I've ever visited. But this is because they're pushing a lot of air through and getting a very high density computation. Yes, I agree that the Russians are very likely to play a key role, and probably in close cooperation with the European Union as well.
Okay. Let's jump over to, while we're on that side of the globe, the IESP, the International Exascale Software Project, and if you could give us your perspective on that. I just recently had a conversation that opened my eyes to a few things, and one person said, a person whose opinion I respect, said that he believes that IESP has been far from as effective as it could be because of personal agendas, and mostly because of the companies involved being worried about preservation of their existing commercial markets. Do you have any thoughts on this you'd like to share?
Yeah. Well, first, let me say a couple of positive things about IESP, because it's easy to poke holes at it, and I'll do so in a moment. But I want to be very clear on this. There was nothing like IESP before its creation. And I want to congratulate my peers and colleagues and friends in the U.S. as well as those in other countries for working together and taking the time and making the initiative to establish at least one forum that is globe straddling in talking about and considering the different possibilities. The possibilities for developing a shared and common software stack that would allow all the nations to leverage the investment of other nations, that would allow resources to be shared, therefore, but also providing common frameworks and interfaces, standards, that would allow a commonality of usage of different layers in the machine. So I want to be clear on this. People like Pete Beckman and Jack Dungara in the U.S., Paul Messina as well, and there are many others, Satoshi Matsuoka in Japan, and Bernd Moore and Thomas Leppert and others in Europe. Again, there's a wide range of people, and I apologize to those who I didn't mention. The very creation of such an entity, such an international forum, is worthy of praise. So let me be clear about that. And as a result of that, there have been many, many discussions, both structured and informal, that have helped to build a sense of community in the world of exascale. So I want to make it clear that I consider those important positives. Unfortunately, with that kind of initiative, one would have hoped for much more. And now I speak from a personal opinion, and I represent a minority view, not a majority view, in the community. Therefore, your listeners can frankly dismiss this if they feel that they wish to do so. The IESP discussions have been very conventional and very conservative. Part, but by no means all of that, has been related to the roadmaps of individual industry partners. And this is true. There is a need to position their market share and their directions, and unfortunately, IESP has served as a forum that has done that. You'll find that the U.S. wants to play a leadership role, but Europe wants to play a very strong leadership role now. So there's a strong European pushback with their own EESI being represented, the European Exascale Software Initiative. I encourage and I compliment them on that initiative. But it is acting as a fragmenting or balkanizing factor. Even within the U.S., I would say the majority view has been conservative, with the basic idea of incrementally changing that software that we have now rather than replacing it with some alternative software base. I represent the minority view that feels that we require, as we have in the past, a distinct and different execution model that exploits current and future technologies because of the nature of those technologies requiring different approaches, and a large part of my collegial base wants to make extensions to MPI, maybe involving OpenMP, maybe involving OCL or CUDA, and building some sort of complex programming structure. I simply feel that that is not practical, nor does it adequately address the fundamental technical challenges that we face. And so IEFP has been overly conservative, and I've been disappointed in that, although I will say, to their credit, they allowed one working group to at least discuss these issues of revolutionary approaches at the more recent meeting in Cologne, Germany, a few months ago. So I also feel that, IEFP is perhaps forced a degree of pressure on government agencies and limiting their ability to try to be innovative, that is to say the agencies, in setting up new programs. And I feel that that's unfortunate.
As do I. So I always associate the X-Stack with IESP. That's the first place that I connected the two and read about them together. But I understand now there's a new or newer X-Stack program about to emerge, I guess is the right way to say it. But what can you tell us about that, Thomas?
The word X-Stack is such a great name that it's been used for multiple things. I actually thought I invented the term and others took it from me, but I'm afraid it probably gestated in multiple places at the same time, right? There was an early, rather modest X-Stack program out of DOE Office of Science a couple of years ago, and a number of research projects awarded. I was one of the reviewers on that. I didn't submit myself. There was an X-Stack proposal that was written by a large group of colleagues in the U.S., reviewed and was declined. And then most recently, there is the current FOA a release from the Department of Energy on X-Stack, with an emphasis on parallel programming and programming environments and systems. And I think that this FOA is the new and important program because, again, this is my viewpoint, it allows for real innovation, real initiative in alternative approaches, while demanding responsible environments in supporting legacy codes and legacy skill sets. So it is not a pie in the sky. It knows it has a critical responsibility to the national code base and agenda. I feel this is a very exciting program, of course, underfunded, but what isn't? And I look forward to participating with my colleagues on such a project and interacting with other projects that will be awarded in this multiple award program. So you find X-Stack really is becoming a generic, sort of like Kleenex and Xerox, where we are referring to a collection of software, from whatever the source, that will serve a broad community in supporting the billion-way parallelism or more, as well as the efficiencies required for reducing power costs and improving reliability. And that's what I think is coming out of it. So X-Stack has become a generic.
Got it. Okay. Now, a more sensitive topic then. We in several issues in the past, have talked about the, I guess, overabundance of hype in particular markets, and going back to what I believe was an extremely negative impact on the grid computing market. And in some sense, we're seeing some of that with Exascale, with companies saying they already know how we're going to get there. And really, I mean, honestly, we know that there's really not a solid roadmap, and it's far too soon for anyone to say that they know how we're going to get there. Do you have any thoughts on this? I mean, is this, am I overreacting to this? And, you know, what do you think?
Yeah, well, first of all, it's important to understand that people who are saying that they know how to get there, some of those are really smart people. And they have been part of past, sometimes DARPA-sponsored studies, and we have looked at this. And I think that if you have lampposts, well, made out of laser beams, and you look under the lampposts, admittedly rather narrow points, you will find operating points, which means application-driven operating points, where because of the nature of the specifics of the applications, we begin, energy and power aside, we begin to see potential opportunities in short term. Many of the challenges that are more that are required for more general exascale are eliminated by specific characteristics of such applications. And this includes, by the way, some with such strong locality, the data movement is almost eliminated, and that's a major source of energy. And so you begin to see, for these key operating points, the potential of imagining something close to exascale by 2020. However, those preclude, as is already happening within the field of HPC, even as we approach 10 petaflops, those preclude such a wide base of applications and execution modalities that they're essentially defining, in my opinion, specialty machines. I don't perceive exascale as a specialty or boutique arena. I demand from exascale that it in fact serve at least, if not more broadly, a community of applications than we do today. And so my feeling is that there are people that within the very narrow confines can, with some degree of correctness, define a kind of exascale computing. But if you use the word general purpose, then I simply think that they're off base. The challenges of at least 10 to the fourth increase in parallelism, just to start with, is enough. And the fact that we have more than order of magnitude deficiency, even on conventional platforms for a broad range of applications, says that we already recognize that we are failing. There are applications today which are simply not scaling. And because multi-core has become the new Moore's law, that means that those applications will not increase the performance as the technology improves. This is not a perturbation. This is a change. This is a complete revolution in supercomputing. And therefore, yes, I feel that there's a degree of naiveness and sometimes self-serving misinformation that is being promulgated by some agencies, industries, and individual practitioners.
Okay. We, Thomas, recently did I'm doing a poll among colleagues in the media and publishing industry who obviously don't want their names being printed in the exascale report. So I thought it was kind of good. These are the guys that are trying to watch what's happening and write about, you know, the events and so forth. And in that poll, we're asking, who do they see as the top one or two or three influencers as related to the development of exascale? Top one, two, or three influencers can be companies or people or even countries, if you will. I'd like to get your reaction to what I'm finding. So far with the survey results, the number one influencer in helping, I'm trying to read this here, helping us achieve exascale has been listed as Cray. How do you think of it, Laura? What do you think about that?
That's an interesting comment. I have congratulated Pete Ungerer in building a stronger and more stable company and delivering to the community, including the mission critical agencies, a solid family of machines that allows software developers, at least, to address key end-user problems. And by providing that stability, it has certainly helped the high-performance community, HPC community in the U.S., and I would hope that they will be capable of delivering exascale machines of unknown design by the end of this decade. Let me say a positive and negative. The positive is their multiple iterations on building a backbone network which has been a painful and slow process. Nonetheless, it's yielded a very high bandwidth, low latency, and now relatively stable network, to their credit. For their next class machines, like the Titan, to be installed, the Titan machine at Oak Ridge to be installed shortly. That's the positive. The negative, Cray has stepped away from architecture, at least processor core architecture. And I believe that there is a need for real innovation in processor core architecture, certainly for the obvious requirements of energy and reliability, active energy and reliability enhancements, but also for key mechanisms that will be needed for system-wide architecture. Recognizing that Steve Scott, one of this nation's finest architects, after many years at Cray and having singular contributions, has moved to NVIDIA, should be an alert to everyone to ask a serious question. Is Cray capable of taking on the level of innovation essential for a game-changing approach to parallel computing by the end of this decade? So I'm a little surprised that Cray would be first and foremost on that list.
Well, and it may surprise you to know that the number two selection on that list was NVIDIA. And I know that you have mixed feelings about NVIDIA in that role as well. So what do you have to say about those, about that selection?
Well, certainly one wouldn't be surprised. NVIDIA has achieved, and to some degree justifiably, a really strong buzz in the community. Again, if you're looking at my my laser lampposts, and looking under the lamppost light, therefore, NVIDIA has shown and demonstrated performance advantages, again, some normalizing factors between one and two orders of magnitude. NVIDIA also has attracted just some tremendous skill. I mentioned Steve, but long-term members such as David Kirk, these are outstanding people, and that they have been able to bring a narrow special-purpose technology to a broader arena, really to their credit. I think that there's a degree of people grabbing something because it's easy to get some benchmarks very high, and frankly, it's harder to do so with multi-core. When they attracted Donald Becker, certainly a former collaborator of many years ago, to go there as well, it told me they were very serious on the software side and in the system software side as well. And I'm only mentioning a few. Of course, Steve Keckler, as well as the stint that Bill Daly from Stanford played at NVIDIA. I mean, there's just a powerhouse of talent there. You're sticking an accelerator at the wrong end of an I.O. channel. We've done this before at least a couple of times over the last 20 to 30 years. The old guard, including myself, remember the FPS 120s where we had accelerators. This is not a long-term solution. The latencies and bandwidth problems, the relatively small amount of memory tightly coupled to the cores, this system architecture, this particular hybrid system architecture, has some opportunities, but in the long term, I don't consider that to be the end solution. However, much of the technology is better integrated in a heterogeneous machine. On the other side, on the short side, and with a more advanced and dynamic memory managers, maybe embedded memory processors, I can see this path contributing as part of the solution to exascale. They certainly have convinced me of the value of reconsidering heterogeneous processing for that purpose. I think them being near the top of your poll list is more of a knee-jerk reaction than it is a deep thought. But there's no question that if they play it right and they're prepared not to rest on their laurels, that they can be a key contributor to future generations machines, possibly exascale.
Very well said. So, Thomas, let me put you on the spot here, if you don't mind, for the final question of this interview and ask you, what is your message for U.S. policymakers that are responsible for technology R&D budgets as it relates to exascale in 2012?
In 25 words or less, right?
Sure.
It's parts A and B, very simple. A, the federal government is responsible for ensuring that America is in a leadership role, both for industry and economy on the one side and national security on the other. And that's the first message. The second message is high-performance computing, and in particular exascale, has to be invented. It cannot simply be dictated, extracted, or incrementally advanced with the assurity of achieving the necessary goals. And that invention requires fundamental research investment, which must come from the U.S. federal government and transferred to industry. So that's the message.
All right. Thomas, thank you very much for joining us for this program at the Exascale Report.
Mike, thank you very much for the opportunity of speaking to your readership on this very important topic. And a happy new year to you and to all of them.
Thank you. We've been talking with Thomas Sterling, professor at the School of Informatics and Computing at Indiana University. For the Exascale Report, I'm Mike Bernhardt.